Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
That was great. I wish you said, with my friend that I had dinner with in Belfast.
Yes, well, he's a wonderful man. Please check him out on the web. So
now you are a pretty wonderful lady, because I would like to just give a little introduction for the people. I'm sure most of our attendees know who you are, but you are the co-founder and director of Innovation, Vision, and Creativity for the Trauma Resource Institute. Great title. You're the author of Building Resiliency to Trauma, the Trauma and Community Resiliency Model. And you're an international speaker, teacher, and consultant, and advocate for climate and the human condition. And on behalf of the humans, I'd like to thank you as I turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you so much, Leela, for introducing me in such a nice way. Well, welcome everyone. And I see that there's people from Australia and Montana. I didn't see everyone, but I'm just welcoming, whether it's morning, afternoon, or evening. It's evening in California where I live. And it's my joy to describe a little bit about what's been my life's work and my passion and my commitment. I always like to talk about passion a little bit, because, you know, passion comes from the root word to suffer. And so whenever you bring something forward, it can be full of joy and full of suffering. And isn't that sometimes how life is? So let's get started. And I want to start out by asking you to answer, inviting you to answer these two questions. What or who is helping you the most right now? What or who has helped you get through hard times in the past? We call this a resiliency pause. And I would like to invite you, if you're willing, to put in your answer into the chat. So we'll just take a few moments as people are putting that in. And I am going to put mine, because I think one of the things for me is my granddaughter. So I'm seeing that people are saying my cat, friends, family, self. Right now, meditation and inner peace with myself, my spiritual practice, my mother and sister. Tony, whoever that may be, body-based practices, coming home to myself, meditation. So as we're going through the presentation today, I'm going to invite you maybe at times to remember this resiliency pause that we just took, and to integrate it perhaps in your thought, and maybe even to bring it to sensation and to notice what it's like. I know that when I think about my granddaughter, look, and I put my hand to my heart, I can feel this warmth that kind of comes throughout my entire body. And so what we'll say about the community resiliency model is we are a trauma-informed and resiliency-informed model of intervention. We have taken it all over the world. I think so far it's like in 103 countries, which just completely blows me away, because back in 2006, I don't think I had that expectation. But sometimes when you put one foot in front of the other, things happen in the way that life unfolds itself. So one of the things that you'll hear me say is what else is true, that most of us have not gotten out of this life without having some sort of trauma. And our experience has been, as I've been in the aftermath of typhoons, earthquakes, mass shootings, is that there always is something else that's true. And there's a hopeful side of individuals that can pop through when least expected, when things have happened that have been of great difficulty in our lives. And I'd like to believe that what we do with our model is that we cultivate that. But because I'm talking about the community resiliency model, I want to give you our definition of resiliency. Because if you popped the word resiliency into Google, you could get a million different definitions. And actually, I've even heard sometimes people saying, I don't know, resiliency is overused, and it's kind of a word that I don't even like anymore. So I want to start out by telling you and sharing with you the way that I define it. And that is, resiliency is an individual and community's ability to identify and use individual and collective strengths in living fully with compassion in the present moment, and to thrive while managing the activities of daily living. So one of the things that we've learned with the community resiliency model is that people tend, if they like the skills, they integrate them into their activities of daily living, and they start to begin to see that there's a shift that happens, and it's an embodied shift, because the sensory system is such a key part and foundational to the work that we do. So the goals of the community resiliency model, which we want to share with children, teens, adults within communities, the skills, the wellness skills of the model. But we also, which is a little bit different, so I know that many people that are let's say, body workers, mental health professionals that may be listeners, but we want to create a cadre of community resiliency model teachers made up of not only professionals, but natural leaders of communities. We go many places in the world, but maybe there's one therapist for, I can remember in Haiti, I met the one psychologist in the Central Plateau, and she figured that she was serving 60,000 people. So how could one person possibly serve that many? So then in the communities that we've been to, also in my country, in the United States, as well as in other countries around the world, who may not have a lot of therapists, they always have wizened people. It may be the woman that lives down the block. It may be a minister. It may be a community leader, but they're already the go-to person. So what we have found as we share these skills with the natural leaders, that they are the best ones to share well-being that actually can also result in greater mental and physical health. So we've also created ideas to strengthen community. And this is something I hope that you will see as we come through my little presentation today, that it's possible to bring these kinds of resiliency skills to wider communities. I know I have a new friend from Syracuse, and we've seen this in Syracuse, New York, where we trained a few people to be community resiliency model teachers, and they now have sprinkled their community with these wellness skills. But we've seen this in many parts of the world. But the other thing about the model, I like to think about it, it has a perspective shift. In many places in the world, we think conventional thinking may say, oh, people are bad. We just need to punish them. We, you know, stop making excuses. What is wrong with that person, or what is wrong with you? Some of you may know what I'm saying along those lines. But trauma-informed, that started spreading throughout the United States about 15 years ago, started saying, wait, people are suffering. We need to think about effective interventions. And oh my gosh, things that happened to them in the past are affecting them in the present moment. So we need to ask the question, what happened to them? What happened to you? And then maybe then we can have a more compassionate vista. But for some of us, it stopped there. It didn't go to, okay, if that's true, then how can we help those of us, which is including ourselves, start to heal from the things that have happened to us? So that's what we call resiliency informed, that I have seen that people are resilient all over the world, and they need our compassion. And that they can learn skills to self-regulate and learn how to work with their body. And I've seen this in little children. I've seen this in the very old. And so the questions that we ask, like the resiliency questions I asked in the beginning, have to do is, well, what's right with you? What are your strengths? What are the things that helped you get through? That question again, what else is true? One of the purposes of our organization too, which has so much to do right now, in the world where we're seeing social unrest, we're seeing political unrest. Certainly in the United States, we've seen a reawakening for many people about the effects on racism in our community. So one of the things that we try to do with this model is bring the lens of the community resiliency model to create safer spaces for dialogue. Because when we show up in our resilient zone, which I'll explain in just a second, we're showing up as our best selves. And then we can embrace our differences with respect and honor the lived experiences of all our communities, remembering what binds us as a world community. I think when I travel the world, I'm always so touched that we have so many more things that we're connected and that are the same than we have differences of the things that we want in life, like to protect our children, our family, to make sure there's proper housing and food, those sorts of things, and also social justice. So these are our core values of service, social justice, dignity, respect, and most importantly, the worth of every person, family, and community. So what are the key concepts? So let's get into the nitty-gritty. We all have the access to the language of our biology and a framework to help understand our human experience. And so even if you're saying, I don't know, what do you mean about the biology? We'll talk a little bit more about that. But oftentimes in Western thinking, we've left the body out. It's like, I think, therefore I am. But it's not only what we think and what we feel, but what we sense. And that's one of the core tenets of the community resiliency model. Now, there are 6 wellness skills that are so simple. Someone sent me a video of a 3-year-old sister teaching her 1.5-year-old brother one of the skills. I have to tell you, that was a joyous moment for me, because if we can help children, right, wouldn't that be something, if they can learn from a very early age how that they can not only feel and think, but also how they sense and how self-regulation skills can help them. So we have used these skills across the lifespan. We've used it across cultures. Every time I go to a new culture, I'm going, oh, I wonder if it's going to work in Nepal. And it does, because we're designed very similarly, right? As in terms of Syracuse or California or Australia, we've actually just had, because now we're doing so many things on Zoom, we've just recently had a number of people come in from Australia to become community resiliency model teachers. So we've also seen that, some individuals in our world do not have the advantage of education. It doesn't mean that they're not smart, but they may not be able to read or write. So we have found that we can teach this to people that may not have the advantage of literacy. And also with little ones who are just learning how to read, we can still help them learn how to read their nervous system. And so the model is based on laws of nature. You know, just like there are stormy days, there are days when the sun comes out. My new friend, Sandy, comes from Syracuse. It gets very cold there. And I've been in very cold snowstorms there. In California, where I live, we rarely get that kind of weather. But in any event, we have nature. We have the cycles of the moon. We have the ocean waves that come to shore and recede. And we have those same kinds of events that happen within our body. And some of you know when you've had storms inside of your body, when you felt you just couldn't get away from the storm. Some people have just described it like a beating drum that would not let you go. But what we've learned is that we could also start paying attention and cultivate our well-being. And that can grow and expand and transform our experience so that we don't have to be trapped by, let's say, the stresses or traumas that we've experienced in our lives. So the model is based on neuroplasticity. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I have to tell you that I was never crazy about science when I was a kid. I love it now. And I even the word neuroplasticity, oh my gosh, what does that mean? I think one of the talents that I've been given is to try to take complex subjects and make them simple. And basically, it just means the brain can change so that each one of you, if you've had trauma or you work with people that have been traumatized, that you can tell them there's hope. Because through cultivating our well-being and paying attention to it, there's something called neurogenesis, is the ability to create new neurons or brain cells and connections between those brain cells throughout a lifetime. My father-in-law died last year. He was 105. And I have to tell you, I shared these skills with him. And he could actually say, oh, Lynn, I feel so much better now. My knees aren't bothering me in the same way as they used to. Because I would remind him that he had very strong arms. And I said, well, Kenny, you push that wheelchair, the walker all over the house. He goes, you're right, I do. And he'd even make a joke saying, I think my arms are stronger than yours. And he was probably right. So again, we can do this throughout our lifetime. So as I said already, we focus on the biology and of the human nervous system. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. And that we have seen all over the world, I've asked the same six questions and people give the same results everywhere we go. So there are common reactions to stressful and traumatic events that do affect the mind, body, and spirit. But we've so learned that when we learn how to read the nervous system, it can transform our present moment experience and really help us cultivate our well-being. So the first thing we try to do is create a common language. And some of you may have even heard of some of this common language that we talk about or seen it called something differently, because we know that inside of ourselves, we have a rhythm. And if you'd like to do this with me, you can kind of just move your hand up and down. And this is called our resilient zone or the okay zone. Children call it the okay zone. We ask kids what they wanted to call it. And so, and in that resilient zone, it's kind of our vitality. It's our well-being. Now, it's not just a happy space, which is why we have a slide in front of you that has, can you be excited in the resilient zone? Yes. Can you be angry? Yes. Can you be happy and sad? Yes. But you feel you can handle the array of emotions in the human experience when you're in that zone, and you don't lose your capacity to think and to respond with maybe even, because anger is part of living, right? And so we can get angry with, because there's maybe an intention to get angry because someone has harmed us, but still express ourselves of maybe why we're angry and how we may have a dialogue so that we can come to some common solution. So I had one little boy tell me once, and I just let it, he goes, Elaine, you mean I can be okay sad and okay mad? I said, yes, you can. He goes, well, you know, I think I have been. So out of the mouth of children, right? And so I love working with kids with this model, because kids get it so quickly about their body, because they're closer to it than many of us as adults. So this is another. So here we have the resilient zone, but we have this little thunderbolt here, which could be a reminder of a traumatic or stressful event, or it can be something that's happening in the present moment. I mean, since COVID-19 has impacted the entire world, people have shared with me that they are feeling sometimes that they can get out of their resilient zone quite quickly, and they can get stuck in what we call the high zone. And you can see we have some emojis here that, and when you're in your high zone, you can feel you're angry, you're upset, you know, nothing's going well. And maybe you even say things that you regret. Or you can also go into the low zone where you're feeling, I'm exhausted. I can't get out of bed. I can't take one more minute of sheltering in space. And so to know that many of us are going into these states right now with more frequency because of life experience. But I think it's also important to know, and you can just think about this yourself. Has anybody besides me, because I certainly have been in my high zone, is anybody else? Maybe, yes. And then how about in the low zone? I've been there too, right? And so to know that, and also hopefully you've been in the okay zone. And this is the human experience. I've asked that question all over the world. So let's see. Okay. Oh, I see. I hid some things from you. You can see these are some of the ways that you might feel when you're in that high or low zone. So I actually made this. We have a group of children from a school that has adapted the model in Atlanta. And I was there recently, and one of the teachers said, oh, Lynn, come and talk to the kids. I go, okay. So these really lovely little boys who were so smart, they were like 10 years old. And they said, well, you know, we don't like that diagram. And I said, you don't? No, because sometimes you can go to the high and low zone and never go through the resilient zone. I said, oh my gosh, you're right. It's more like a sphere, Elaine. You need to make a sphere. So this was my attempt to pay attention to those little boys, right? Because we do have a resilient zone, but for some of us, we may not go through it. We go from high to low, especially times of great distress that we may be happening in our lives. All right. So tracking the autonomic nervous system. I'm going to ask you all to do something with me. It's always an invitation, but I'm sitting in a chair. So maybe some of you can stand up. But right now, I'm going to try to get our autonomic nervous system working. So I'm going to be sitting in place, and I'm going to be moving my hands and moving my legs. And I'm going to ask you guys to do it with me. So move your arms and your legs really fast as you can. So we're going to get our heart rate up. Okay, a little bit longer. Okay, all right, a little bit longer. Oh, okay, stop. Now, I can notice that my heart rate is up a little bit. So that is your sympathetic nervous system. Maybe you're noticing that as well. And also, you may notice other things too. Maybe you notice, gosh, my mouth's a little dry now. How did that happen? Because when we access the sympathetic nervous system, which is part of the way we're elegantly designed, it shuts down our digestion and saliva because it needs everything for action, right? We were moving our extremities, our arms and our legs. And so the sympathetic nervous system is very important, especially when we're talking about stress and trauma, because for some of us, when we have had a lot of trauma or stress in our life, we could be sitting in the chair like I am right now, but our heart rate is always beating fast. And so if that happens over years, then that also can deplete our immune system. So that's really important that there's some things, of course, that happen automatically, which is why it's called the autonomic nervous system. But there are some things that through the body, we can start to shift. So right now, I'm going to ask you to do something else, is to move very slowly, like in slow motion. And if we were in person, when I go into the field and work with children, I have children, I ask them, what's a really fast animal? And then I'll say, what's one that moves very slow? So that they can actually start to learn to read their nervous system through playing and acting out animals. So many of you may notice, if you stop now, that your breathing rate has slowed down and that maybe your heart rate has slowed down a bit. Some of you may even, I just took a little deeper breath, but also you may notice that saliva comes back into the mouth and you may even feel your tummy gurgling a bit, because those are natural signs of the autonomic nervous system. So in the model, we help children and adults learn how to read their nervous system. And what we've seen around the world, and I'm not going to go, this is a very dense slide, and I put this in here because these are the answers I've seen. This is not an exhaustive list. When I've asked the questions, since this trauma happened or during COVID-19, have you noticed changes in your thinking or physical changes or spiritual changes, or have there been changes in behavior, or how about relationships, or have there been emotional changes? And these are common things that people say in every country I've been to. So sometimes thoughts get more paranoid. Sometimes there's nightmares. Sometimes everyone looks like a threat. Sometimes we feel like we're not even in our body. Maybe we'll make poor decisions. So take a look at this list, and just to know that it's not exhaustive, but if you see that, oh my goodness, I've been feeling that way, to know that's very common. And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. That just means that you're incredibly human. But of course, it can get problematic with that high and low zone that we talked about if you get stuck in those spaces. And that's when we can have symptoms of anxiety, post-traumatic stress, injury, or we can start suffering from depression. So it's important that we start to read the nervous system, because one of the most important things I'm going to say to you, people often ask me, like in 2019, I traveled 120,000 miles on American Airlines. Oh my gosh, too much. But this year, because of COVID, I've hardly traveled at all. But people would ask me, well, Elaine, what do you do when you go to these other countries? And I said, well, I think simply, I help people understand and start to discern the differences between sensations of distress and sensations of well-being inside their bodies. And when they do that, they can have a choice of what to pay attention to. We may not have had a choice that we had abuse in the past. We may not have a choice that we have to deal with this horrible pandemic right now. But we do have a choice of, like, when we're feeling safer or a little bit having a space that we can start tracking and reading our sensations of well-being. So I prepared this slide. I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but because we are in the time of COVID right now, I think it is important that we at least pay attention that this is going on. And these are some of the things that people have shared with me about the actual events in their life that are concerning: the job layoffs, the grief, the financial, housing, and food insecurity, really the disruption of the social network. I've certainly felt that. I'm a big extrovert. I used to have people come over to my home all the time. Of course, that's changed now. But also the fear of catching or spreading the virus to others, a lot of anxiety about the unknown, and also there can be stigma and polarization even within families. Do you wear a mask or not? And then if we do have a chronic mental health condition or challenge, or we work with people with those conditions, then sometimes that means that their symptoms are exacerbated, they're more intense. But we have learned that by learning these simple wellness skills, it can help to regulate your nervous system so that you can be more present in mind, body, and spirit to even figure out what you need to do in terms of going forward in life. But as much as we've seen the common complaints, we've also seen these common reactions connected to well-being, the strength and courage, joining together with a joint purpose. People have shared with me the most amazing appreciation of their loved ones, increase in their faith, sometimes forgiveness. And what I've seen, when people can get into that okay zone, that resilient zone, they have greater compassion for themselves and others. And that has been why I think that this particular way, and when we're embodied, has incredible implications for those of us that work in the social justice arenas. So I'm going to say this simply: why biological models? The ACEs study, the Adverse Child Experiences study, and I know that many of you know this already, but it was very important. I was also in my past a teacher of family medicine. I worked for a large hospital in California teaching young doctors. And when that was first published in 1997, I, as a social worker, knew that when you had trauma as a kid, it affected your health. But many times, like in medicine, that connection wasn't made. And when the Adverse Child Experience study was published out of research that was done in Kaiser Permanente in San Diego, California, it was the first thing that I saw that there were like 10 adverse experiences, which are number one. You know, things like a parent with a mental illness, or a parent that was incarcerated, or whether you experienced emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, that if you had four or more, you had exponentially higher rates of, let's say, pulmonary lung disease or diabetes or hypertension, and also depression, anxiety. And if you had six or more, and that's what this is, the one that stuck in my head, your life span was shorter by 20 years compared to those who had zero. Since that first study was done in 1997, they've now added the community violence and the things that happen in many of our communities around the world. But also number three is climate change. And we've certainly seen that in California with the firestorms, and seeing that there's people from Australia here, I know that you have also experienced horrible firestorms as well. So these things, of course, impact children and impact adults and impact our nervous systems. And that's why we need to really think that if we're having what's called toxic stress, some people call it trauma, which can be too much too fast, or too little for too long, or too much for too long, that can dysregulate the nervous system. And how do we help children and adults to kind of get back into what we call that resilient zone again? But it's also important in today's world to think about intersectionality. So when things happen to us, they don't happen to us in a vacuum. So if you're a certain gender, and we know, for example, that women have higher rates of post-traumatic stress injury than men do, but you're not only a woman, you may, let's say that you're have an ability challenge that you've lost the use of your legs. And let's say you come from an economically challenged social class. And let's say you're African-American. So all those factors intersect and can also be the perfect storm of the nervous system. They can also have given you a lot of grit in terms of how you get through life experiences. But I think it's important for us to remember that things don't happen by themselves, and that there's other identifiers. We just put four in this little box, but also that there's the impact of historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, and certainly we've seen this in the United States, structural and systematic racism, and how that also impacts our nervous systems, not only individually, but collectively, which is why I was intrigued with this conference, because it was talking about also social change, because many of us work in settings where we're seeing one person. And that doesn't mean that one person, you change that one person, they may be changing their family and all of society. But how do we bring things to more people to spread the news that it's important to pay attention to embodiment? And of course, that's what I think we are doing with the community resiliency model. But see, the ACEs takeaway for me is this physiological response begins in childhood and has implications for mental health and outcomes throughout a lifetime. And what we have seen commonly as behavioral problems are really connected to adverse child experiences. And if we embrace that idea, then how can we crack policy and changes and also include the body in our interventions? So if it happens in the body, then there has to be a biological interventions. And many of us, I know, in this conference work in this area. But I think we have to think about how do we bring it to the masses. So that now brings me to the skills. Is she ever going to get to the skills? Of course I am. I'm doing good with my time. So I found this slide. I said, got skills, like got milk. And that's how I think it needs to be so universal, right? So when I was in, we've done a project with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And last year I was in New Delhi when we were launching this project, which is called the Sea Learning Program. And I do have it in the slides. It's through Emory University, and it's a curriculum for children, kindergarten through 12. And the Community Resiliency Model is chapter 2 of this incredible free curriculum that all of you could go down today and download it and start to think about how you can integrate it into your household, with your children, with your schools. But one of the participants, a really lovely man from Spain, said to me, Ghislaine, he goes, you know, we're used to when we have a contemplative practice and with meditation and mindfulness, is that just we pay attention to the sensation. And you pay attention to it long enough, it will shift. And so that's true. And I love meditation and love contemplative practices. But I said, why would I want to do that with a child if there is something that could be maybe a little bit faster that can then lead to them having a contemplative practice? And to me, if I'm going to work with children around the world, I would want to have them have a life vest on so that when they go into the stormy waters of life, that they have some skills that are their own that they can come to use for themselves. And so he said, well, that makes sense. And then I had, it was really great. I had a Tibetan monk that was there who's actually integrated the skills in his school in Dharamsala. And he said, what she's saying is right. Because once you're in your resilient zone, you can then have a contemplative practice that can be not so busy, that actually can, and I don't know if I don't like this name, but not that I would want to fast track it, but to help children even early on to be able to learn those self-regulation skills so that other wellness skills can be more available to them. So we have 6 skills. I'm not going to probably be able to share all of them with you today, but I do want to tell you that we have an iChill app that you can go to listen to that's completely free. It's in English and Spanish that will go over some of those skills. But first of all, and this may be blasphemous for some of you, in our community resiliency model, you don't have to talk about the past if you don't want to. So if you're talking to someone one-on-one, I can often say you can share as little or as much as you want about what happened to you. And some people are so relieved that they don't have to say whatever it is again. And I said, because I can help you learn these wellness skills that have to do with your biology and the elegant design of the human nervous system. And you know, sometimes the body has a wisdom that words cannot speak. And so I try to bring in language and ideas that can help that expand. Oh, here's the iChill app. I forgot I put it in here. So there it is, free on the Apple and the Droid store. And also because we've traveled so much around the world, some people don't have smartphones. They still have flip phones, but most people have access to a computer. And so you can see iChillApp.com is available and you can listen to the skills there. Okay, so tracking. So I want to talk a bit about tracking. And that's reading sensations. And so I've been talking about this already, like we have these doorways of expanding well-being. And we often, there's many psychological interventions that talk about, well, if you change what you think, you can change how you experience the world. Or if you just emote and express your feelings, you'll feel better. Well, I found that for some people that's true, but for many others, it's not. Because sometimes we can have all the insight in the world, but if all of a sudden there's a multi-sensory reminder of our trauma, our body can start to shake and shiver, and sometimes we don't even know why it happened. And that's why the door of sensation is so important. So it's foundational. It is paying attention to sensation and of what is happening in the body, because what we pay attention to grows, and that's based in neuroscience. That is from Hebbian theory. Carla Schatz, who's a brilliant woman from Harvard, said, I'm trying to get this out of the way. So what the brain cells that fire together, wire together. So they become stronger. So I try to use the metaphor of a garden. Most places in the world, we have gardens. We also have weeds in gardens, but let's say you've planted some great vegetables. And so as you planted the vegetables, but for some reason, if you only decided to water the weeds, what's gonna happen to your garden? The weeds will spread. So I think sometimes in Western approaches, we focus so much on talking about the trauma, we've forgotten to cultivate the other aspects of what else is true. I've asked that question with so many people and they go, oh, well, yes, it was really terrible, but I remember that, but my grandmother would come over and when she would come over, it felt like everything was gonna be better. So I'd say, oh, well, tell me more about your grandmother. And that's not to cut off the trauma story. It's also just to expand the awareness of, yes, that happened, but so is this. Because as human beings, we tend to have a negativity focus. And so it can be hard to sometimes shift that, almost like a magnetic pull, to shift to the well-being. So this is what I said earlier, but I have to say it again. Learn to tell the difference between sensations of well-being and distress. So how do we do that? So by asking ourselves a very simple question. So like if you go back to that first thing that I asked you about what helps you get through hard times, you said lovely things in the chat. And so if you think about one of those things, like if I think about my granddaughter, notice I put my hand in my heart again. Is that pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, the sensations connected to my thought of my granddaughter? And I have to tell you, I took a deep breath and it's very pleasant when I think of her. So what we do is we stay with the pleasant or neutral sensations. What's neutral? People have often said to me, well, it's not that it's pleasant, Elaine, but it's the absence of what used to be there. And I'll say, well, would you like to stay with that neutrality? Yes, can you? Oh, well, yeah, I can stay with that. And that for some people is life altering. So asking yourself these two questions, what do you notice on the inside, and are the sensations pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? So here's a wonderful slide that was done from a study that was in Finland, and they actually were shown images and had composite drawings. So they when they had increased sensation, they were invited to draw yellow, and if it was decreased sensation, they were invited to draw blue. And you can see happiness, pride, love, but anxiety and anger also has the yellow. But that's why it's important when we. This is one of the most important things I've learned in doing this work, is that every life experience, every thought, every feeling, every belief has a corresponding sensation in the body. So if you ask me, Elaine, what do you love? And I told you that, and you said, well, what do you notice inside? As I'm just even thinking about that, I feel an expansion. Now, if you ask me, what do you like? Look at, like, even my face changes, right? I can become more contracted. So that is why I can notice that exists, because that's part of the human experience. But then who do I want driving my bus? Do I want the love and compassion that I feel in the world driving my bus, or my fear and disgust? I mean, this is a question for all of us, right? So remember that a sensation is a physical experience in the body, and it originates in billions of receptors all over the body. Okay. So I'm going to talk about this one, and then I'm going to quickly into the second skill that I want to teach you. But you know, this is not just Elaine's bright idea. There's so many people that work in the area of sensation, but there is scientific research on something called interception. And Dr. Martin Paulus is at the University of California in San Diego. And he has found, okay, the insula, which is a part of the brain that helps body and mind communicate to one another. Some people have called it the superhighway of the brain. So it reads the physical states in the body. Like if we have an itch, we're going to itch. If we have a pain, we'll go, oh, what's that pain? Or let's say if you were outside in my neck of the woods today, it was really hot. It was almost 100 degrees. And so it was hot. So if I had a sweater like this on, I would have gone inside and put on a different kind of shirt. So you already work with sensation. And so what we want to do is expand your ability to work with your sensory system. Because what did Martin Paulus find? People that have this ability to observe body sensations in response to what they think and feel, they have better impulse control and better emotional regulation. So there are some positive reasons to do this. Now I'm gonna quickly go, there's learning sensations can be as simple as putting your hands together really quickly, if we can do this, and just rubbing really, really quickly. Yes, and do you notice some temperature change? So then you can stop. Right? So many of you noticed heat, and as you stop, it cools down. So it can be learning a new vocabulary. And on our app, we talk more about this, that you can learn more about sensation. But the best way to learn how to read your nervous system is through cultivating your resources. And resources can be anything. If you look at these people there, they're having a meal. What would be some of the things that would be pleasant for the people in this photo? If we had a lot of time, I'd have you put it in the chat. You might want to do that if you'd like, but they have pizza. They're drinking a, looks like coffee, or maybe it could be hot cocoa. They're laughing. It looks like they like to be with each other. So these would all be resources, because resources are unique to each individual. So resources can be a person, a place, a thing, a memory, a part of yourself that makes you feel calm, pleasant, peaceful, strong, resilient. It can be real or imagined. I have a friend that, you know, loves George Clooney. You'd think that she knew him personally. And that also can be this little girl who happens to be my granddaughter that I've been talking to you about. So I put her in because I made these slides. But as you think, I'd like to invite you right now. This is the important thing that we'll do today before. I know we have about 5 minutes left before we're going to open for questions. But to think for a moment about your resource, but not just think about it, is to, what are some details about it? So I'm going to bring you to this one. Think about your resource and describe three qualities about the resource to yourself. And as you describe those resources and the qualities, notice the sensations connected to your resource as you describe the qualities. And I'm going to invite you to take about 15 seconds to really pay attention. And also, I just want to say too, when we start talking about resources, sometimes there can be tears in our eyes because sometimes they might call up a beloved person who may not be on the planet anymore. But I just want to invite you to try to cultivate the things about, let's say if it was a person that called that person up to begin with as a resource. So just take a few seconds. So research says it takes about 15 seconds to cultivate that, to really notice. And I noticed I took a deeper breath. If you'd like to report in the chat what you've noticed in terms of sensations, I'd like to invite you to do that. So what's so important for all of us to remember is that we have these available to us, that we can call up a resource that can help us very quickly regulate our nervous system. Now, we have grounding, which I think there's many forms of grounding. On the iChill app, you can listen to our grounding. I think the difference is that we've learned that not everybody can ground in a chair. Give people choices if you're going to take them through a grounding exercise. Some people have been tortured in chairs, so they may need to lay down or stand against a wall. And then we also have been, and you saw me call out my gesture. We have seen gestures all over the world, and gestures, are movements and expressions of the body and limbs that can be protective, they can be powerful, joyful, self-calming. I love this little girl. But they also can be spiritual. But what we found is that think about in your life, is there a gesture that you make that's self-soothing? Like I do this with my thumb. Usually gestures are underneath conscious awareness. See what I'm doing? And sometimes I can, let's say today I could have been, maybe I was a little nervous when I was starting. I could do that and I practice it enough that it causes an immediate calming in the body. So to know that we have this ability, I also want you to take a close look at Help Now skills. We sometimes need to do something which is a resiliency pause that works with sensations because it can be too much to think about a resource because we're so out of our zone. But sometimes we can count down by 10, 10, 9, 8. We can listen to sounds, name colors. We can push against a wall and that can help us down-regulate or up-regulate our nervous system if we're stuck in high or low. And then finally, we have the ability to track those sensations. This is our skill 6. And then say, if we're feeling distress, we can shift to a resource, to grounding, to Help Now, to a self-soothing gesture, or just even a pleasant or neutral sensation in the body. Now, I want to show you this little hand. So this was created by Nobuko Hattori. She's from Japan with our skills. So tracking is in the middle. We have a resource, ground, Help Now, gesturing, shift and stay to help you easily remember. And there's also some dense slides in here that I really encourage you to take a look at. But this is about community, this next one. And how do you do that? Identify your community stakeholders. We're trying to train natural leaders and professionals all over the world so that you could bring these wellness skills because they're also, we have research that's being done at academic settings around the country. And I'm going to just go up to that. In Nursing Outlook, was published in January of this year, showed that after a 3-hour class learning these skills, that nurses after 1 year had higher degrees of well-being and statistically significant reductions in vicarious trauma and post-traumatic stress symptoms. And so this also may sound some blasphemous to some of you, but what we've learned is not everyone wants to reprocess the narrative of their trauma. Sometimes it is enough for many people around the world to feel like they can sense their body, and if they get multisensory triggers of their trauma, that they can intercept the hijacking through these simple skills and come back into that resilient zone. And then they can go to the market. They can go to church or synagogue or their temple, and they can live life and not feel they're being derailed by the traumas that happened to them in the past. We also have studies that have been done in the Journal of Mental Health and Addiction, and there's more being done all the time. You can go to our Trauma Resource Institute. But I also wanted to just let you know that my book, Building Resilience to Trauma, was chosen last year by the United Nations Online Curated Library as one of the concepts that are supporting the United Nations call to action to end poverty, fight inequality and injustice, and protect the planet. And this is what the C Learning program, I want you all to see this. Go to clearning.emory.edu for free to see this amazing curriculum that is all about how to cultivate compassion and ethics in children. And as one smart little kid told me, well, we think chapter 2 should be chapter 1, that's the community resiliency model, because if you're not in your zone, it's very hard to be compassionate. So this is we're Twitter, we Facebook, we do all these kinds of things, at least my staff do. And then this is important. If we scientists in the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute have found that with just 10% of the population holds an unshakable belief, their belief will always be adopted by the majority of society. So if we cultivate well-being, compassion, ethics, it can have an incredible impact. So just think about what's 10%? Of your community, of your church, of your school, of your family. And that's the end. So, you know, our vision is to create resiliency-informed and trauma-informed individuals and communities. And we really want to bring these wellness skills to everyone on earth. And also that really to remember diversity and inclusion would be a world where people of all religions, races, sexual orientation, ages, abilities, and gender identification were equally respected, included, and welcomed. So thank you so much. So there you go. Back to you,
Elaine, that was so inspiring, so worthwhile, so important in the world today. Thank you so much for your work.
You're welcome.
It's really exciting to see how impactful you're being and how much traction you're getting. We have a question from Heidi, which is, yes. I think the CRM model is fantastic and based on a lot of science. I'm curious, what are some of the main sources of funding? It's a nonprofit. It's wonderful you teach these skills.
Okay, believe me, you know, when I started in 2006, it was $5,000 that our five board members contributed $1,000 each. And oh my gosh, that was so exciting that we actually had money to start, right? But I'm happy to tell you that it's expanded over the years, right? So we get funding from private donors. So we're always, you know, trying to say, well, we're doing this great work and we have like a wonderful man in, say, Rwanda, Sam Habimana. And I would love to have more money to send to Sam because he's sprinkling the community resiliency model with the genocides, with survivors of Rwanda. So there's donations. We put on trainings, and there's a portion of our trainings after we pay our staff that goes to a general fund that then funds some of our philanthropic work. So for example, we went to Mexico after their earthquake, and it was totally funded through donations. And like, there's people in Mexico that had places for us to stay. So people have given donations in kind. So when you have a nonprofit, and many of you know this, it's hard to keep things going, but also it's been such a strange thing with the pandemic, which has been surprising to me. We used to do only in-person trainings. And so we've shifted everything. And we have had more people take our trainings in the last 7 months than we could ever imagine. So we've been hiring more staff because these skills really help people with self-regulation during these unprecedented times. We also work we've had a diversity, inclusion, and equity subcommittee that's also working very quickly. I'm not sure why I lost my video. Maybe they're cut. Maybe
I'm
this is
not
the hook.
Either. You know what I'm going to say?
Oh, this is the hook. This is when they're taking me off. We'll just turn our video off.
No. You know what I was going to do is I'm going to ask you to, if you would stop sharing your screen. There we go. Okay. So that's what we have. Oh man, I am so happy that this resource is going because I love that effect of focusing on the, and there's been a lot of the Mr. Rogers quote, like always look for the helpers, and which is nice, but you take that a step further to feel the helpers, to feel that peace.
Yes. And to, you know, to sense it in your body. And you know, that's what we think, right? It's like saving it to the hard drive of your computer. If you don't save a brilliant thing you've written, it's gone. You might be able to remember pieces of it, but it's not the same. But when you sense something like a resource and you really intensify it and stay with it, I call it chasing your resiliency. And people who never thought they could escape those sensations of trauma in their body, I have to tell you, we have so many incredible stories that come from all over the world after the horrible things that sometimes happen to, you know, we humans.
There are some horrible things.
By nature
things.
And at the hands of other humans, yeah.
Well, I have actually, my extended family has had a violent and extreme trauma in the last 2 weeks. And I have been making notes and sending to my niece to get her son. You know, I'm very, very grateful to be learning about your programs. And I know I'm excited to get involved. So I want to encourage everyone to go to traumaresourceinstitute.com to learn more about how you can get involved.
And can I also, can I let people know too that we have a lot of free webinars that are available on the site. And also, of course, you know, in order for us to function, we have to have people pay full price, but we also try that if somebody wants to take our trainings and needs a scholarship, we certainly consider that request. And we do have people that give us donations specifically so that we can provide scholarships. So I'm hoping that people will go there and know that we don't close the door to people in the world, that we really want to be inclusive of our incredible world community.
Yeah, that's great. There is a question that is, I think, a little bigger than we have time for. But what I would like to do is invite people to continue the conversation on the Facebook channel and the coffee area in our portal, which is great. Next up in the trauma and social change channel, we have Jacqueline Richards with how lifting out of the parent traps will invite fun, freedom, and the creation of a new way to be in the world. That sounds wonderful. There is so much good stuff happening in this conference. It is impossible to keep a hold of. Luckily, people have done that for us. Each channel manager has been working diligently with our presenters, and they have made learning, what is it called now? Learning lists for each category so that you can go through logically and build your capacity to understand these things, to see the resources that are available. One of the questions that came in was asking about reference is this sourced on someone's work? All of those kinds of building blocks have been sorted out for us. So I know I am very excited. I have secured myself the library, and I imagine it will take me years to get through it all, but I am fascinated and appreciative. One of the other great things about it is there's the audio only files, so I can download it to my phone and take them with me wherever I go. It also is a wonderful way to say thank you to the presenters if you're able to, because making this available worldwide is going to have an impact on our world as we have people connecting with themselves. We can connect with each other in more compassionate and more beautiful ways. So if you're able to, I really encourage you to purchase the library. We like to end all of our presentations with the key question. And so, Elaine, what is your top tip on how to stay more embodied?
To pay attention to the sensations on the inside, connected to your well-being, and but also to know that you're going to have sensations of distress, and then you have a choice. You can move into paying attention to your well-being to cultivate the garden of wellness that exists, I believe, in all of us.
Oh, cultivate the garden of wellness that exists in all of us. Of course. That was a wonderful answer. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you to everyone who has attended this session. We hope you got
Thank
as much
you,
out
everybody.
Of it as I did.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Bye,
blessings
everyone.
To all of you. Bye-bye.